The same root, eco, in both economics and ecology, and yet we do seem to see it presented by our politicians as somehow at odds with each other. Well, you know, we've got to be mindful of the environment, but we got to balance that with growing the economy and making sure that our economics are sound. So have you been able to trace exactly why that apparent contradiction is there?
Well, I keep saying that we should put the eco back into economics. I think most people, not just politicians, but most people in general, don't realize that the word economics is based on the same word as ecology. And so we disconnect the two. And I think historically, you have to look at the way we evolved. We evolved 150,000 years ago in Africa. And for 95% of our existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. And you know, when you live that kind of an existence, nature is everything. Nature is what you depend on for your well-being and survival. 10,000 years ago, we began the agricultural revolution, which really transformed human beings. But for most of that time, again, we were farming animals. And as farmers, you know that seasons and weather and climate, they impinge very much on your livelihood. That insects, some are pests, but some are absolutely vital for pollination, and certain plants can fix nitrogen from the air as fertilizer. Farmers understand that we are still a part of nature and dependent on it. But suddenly, very suddenly, you get the transformation of humanity. In 1900, the vast majority of Canadians lived in rural village communities. We were still a farming animal. And yet in 100 years, we've been transformed where 85% of us now live in big cities. And in a big city, our highest priority is our jobs. And so the economy then comes to dominate our lives. And nature is something out there. As long as there are parks out there and we can go camping or hiking, then, you know, it's not really relevant to our lives. And we see the world in a radically different way. I think that's a beginning of a big transformation. What do you think, John?
Yeah, you know, I guess one of the problems is when we benchmark our economic expectations, we benchmark to the post-war period, which has been a period of exceptional growth. And I'm not just talking about the Canadian economy, but the global economy. We, of course, attribute that to our own brilliance and ingenuity, but actually cheap fuel is the primary factor. And of course, we no longer have that. The world will never run out of oil in a geological sense, but we are running out of the oil we can afford to burn.
The low-hanging fruit.
That's right. I mean, the same prices that raise 1.5 million barrels a day out of the tar sands translate into the same prices that stop our economies dead in its tracks. And I think we're finding, not just in Canada, but around the world, that, you know, fiscal pump priming or printing money is not a substitute for cheap oil. I mean, we can see the contradictions in that when the governor of the Bank of Canada keeps interest rates basically at zero and then warns us not to borrow, that there's a big disconnect. And what we're finding is that the traditional accelerators for the economy aren't working because they're not a substitute for triple-digit oil prices. That if we benchmark ourselves over a much longer historical epoch, the type of growth that we take for granted, you know, has not been the norm. And I think what we're facing now is a major slowdown in economic growth. I'm not just talking another recession. Recessions are ephemeral, cyclical events that last 3 to 4 quarters. I'm talking about a permanent gear down in the rate at which our economies can grow. Now, in my profession, all the metrics of economic well-being are tied to growth, consumption per capita, income per capita. And by those metrics, slowing down to a much slower rate of economic growth will make us all poor. But I think, you know, what I'm suggesting is that when we look at the kind of impact that economic activity has had on the environment, on the climate, that maybe the totality of our well-being is not the sum of what we consume. That maybe there are other considerations here, and we just might find that the gear down to a slower economic growth is precisely what we need. That maybe we need a smaller human footprint, not just carbon, but otherwise. And I guess that's what David and I are talking about, the intersection of economics and ecology, because by my training and the profession that I come from, a slowdown in economic growth is a pretty apocalyptic event.
Now, of course, when we're you're talking about this whole mandate to grow the economy, and I seem to recall when Elizabeth May secured the leadership of the Green Party, she gave a victory speech and cited you, Dr. Suzuki, saying that infinite growth on a finite planet is the ideology of the cancer cell. And I think, you know, the way you've both explained it, it seems to make sense. You can't grow into infinity, you know, because economics, something's got to collapse along the way. So where is the resistance to politicians, economics? Why is there such a resistance to embracing this message that we've got to change this paradigm?
Well, I think we've got caught up in the sense that growth, steady growth, is the very definition of progress. And we've come to think the economy is the source of everything that matters. And so the economy has to be our highest priority, and steady growth has to be the mantra that we all adopt. So we don't question the whole thing about, we never ask, first of all, what is an economy for? Are there no limits? How much is enough? Are we happier with all this stuff? I mean, those are fundamental questions we should be asking, but we're not asking them. What's intriguing to me is that here's Jeff, you know, a hard-nosed economist who's telling us that there are very strong reasons why steady growth forever is just not going to last. And so he makes sense to me as a partner at this point.
You know, I think most of our opposition, when you talk about GDP growth, what is GDP? I mean, that's an abstraction to most people. 3/4 or 2/3 of what we measure as GDP is personal consumption. So when we talk about we can't grow anymore, it means we can't increase or grow our consumption. And that's where I think we start to get a whole lot of resistance. And again, because we've been led to believe that the measure of our welfare is what we consume. And I'm arguing that whether we make a conscious choice or not, triple-digit oil prices is going to lead us to some pretty green places, because the kind of activity that we've become accustomed to, that we've benchmarked as the norm, is no longer possible. When you triple or quintuple the price of oil, it doesn't just change the speed at which you drive your car. It changes the speed at which your economy can grow.
That translates into other areas. So it's not just, it's costing more money to run your car. It has an impact on food. It has an impact on all these other areas.
Look at food prices. It's not a coincidence that food prices are peaking as oil prices peak, because we eat hydrocarbons. Okay, we use hydrocarbons to create carbohydrates. And if you look at what's happening in the Middle East right now, I think you'll find that this really isn't so much about Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalism. This is about how does a country like Egypt, with 3% of the land arable, feed 80 million people. And, you know, sure, the Middle East is getting more and more money for the oil they pump out of the ground, but unfortunately they're paying for that in the food that they have to import, because we use all those hydrocarbons to grow those carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned the Middle East, and we look at foreign policy as it's expressing itself, as it has expressed itself for the last 10 years, because I think it does seem as if, what's been pointed out is that oil is peaking. And maybe it's a coincidence, but suddenly we're seeing a lot more a more aggressive military policy in the Middle East. So
yeah, but the irony is, every time we've intervened in the Middle East to get more oil, we get less oil. Regime change is always bearish. Iran, they were producing 6 million barrels a day at the time of the Shah. They're barely producing 4 million. Big bad Saddam Hussein, Iraq was producing 3.5 million barrels in the middle 80s. They're barely producing 3 today. And I think when you look around the world, you'll find that, you know, most of our intervention, going back to the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Iran in 1951, which explains a lot of their attitudes towards the U.S., all of it has been motivated to secure more oil supply. And at the end, we've got less oil supply from those areas.
I'm curious to know, though, to what extent our leaders get it. I mean, are these people who understand peak oil, who understand climate change, and who understand that that connection with economics, but they are somehow prisoners of the way the system works?
Well, I think Jeff can answer that one more than I. I feel that our leaders reflect basically what the public perception is, that the economy is something very, very separate from the biosphere that sustains us, so that air, water, land are not relevant really to the economic system. So the whole focus then, by elevating the economy above everything else, mm-hmm. then, you know, whenever there's a recession, concern about the environment just drops to nothing, because the economy has become this high source, and we disconnect ourselves from the place that we live, which is confusing in the current prime minister, who has had childhood asthma. You would think anyone with asthma knows what you put into the air, you're going to end up putting directly into yourself. I did a show on asthma a few years ago, and one of the things I said is wait for a smog alert day in Toronto. We'll go down to the emergency ward and see what happens. I was shocked. When we went down, it was crammed with elders and children, literally suffocating to death as they were rushed in. You think, oh my God, you know, that's a reflection of we are directly affected by what we do to the atmosphere. And I would have thought that Mr. Harper would know that, but he says, no, we can't afford to do anything about what we're putting into the air. I mean, it'll ruin the economy. So he elevates the economy above that. Why that should be, I don't know. But Jeff can certainly tell you.
What about that? Are we talking cognitive dissonance here?
No, you mentioned Elizabeth May. You know, with all deference of the Green Party, how many seats does the Green Party have, okay? How many seats does Stephen Harper have? So let's forget about Elizabeth May and Stephen Harper. Let's talk about the folks who vote for those people, okay? And what they're voting for right now is the primacy of their own economic interest. You know, it's hard to deny climate change. Every passing day, it's harder and harder to believe that this is sunspot activity. But you know what? A lot of the people would argue, yes, we realize down the road that this is going to have huge consequences. It's going to affect future generations. But you know what? In the here and now, I just want to consume. Now, the good news story is, I mean, David's absolutely right. When the economy sputters, environmental legislation and environmental concerns go in the back seat, if not all the way into the trunk. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking Democrat, Republican, da-da-da. The good news is, triple-digit oil prices is going to take that decision right out of our hands, okay? That it's not going to be that we pass cap-and-trade or carbon taxes or do any of the things that maybe we should be doing, because we're not going to be able to combust fuel at the same rate that we have in the past, because our economies are driven by hydrocarbons, okay? Mm-hmm. When GDP growth stops, guess what? Consumption of oil and coal stop growing as well. That's the silver lining mm-hmm. in this story.
And Jeff better be right. If you're wrong, I'm going to be mightily angry at you, because that provides us with a real opportunity. The shock of what higher prices are going to do to us. Provide a moment then, as Naomi Klein says, you know, the shock doctrine. This is when all kinds of big changes can happen. And I think it's a moment to get our economy and ecology right. Before we
here's the challenge. Like, if you're an environmentalist, you're going to go, you know, Jeff, why am I going to gamble the planet's future on your forecast? And that's not an unreasonable thing to ask. And I'm saying, okay, you don't have to wait 10 years to see what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is happening right now. Whether you're in Greece and Spain, China and India, or Canada and the U.S., your economy is growing at a fraction of the pace it used to. And while your leaders are telling you that this is a temporary thing and let's just print some more money or run a bigger budget deficit, you're going to see right now that's not working. And the reason it's not working is because no amount of printing money or spending is going to make $100 oil, $20 oil, or $100 ton coal, $20 ton. So I understand environmentalists saying, hey, Jeff, I'm not going to gamble the planet's future on your forecast. My retort to them is, it ain't a forecast anymore. It's happening right now.
Well, also, I think that as an environmentalist, I have to say, we've really fundamentally failed over the last 50 years. I mean, there was a lot of progress after Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. Certainly, you think of legislation, environment departments, parks, millions of acres of parks have been preserved. But in terms of shifting the way we see our place on the planet, mm-hmm. we haven't succeeded in that.
You know, like, I've got an environmentalist and an economist, and I'm starting to think I should also have a pathologist with us too, because it seems like the behavior in response to the phenomena that you're, pointing to, it's to just continue doing what we're doing. It's like, so the response to triple digit oil, we got to mine the tar sands, or go to war for oil in the Middle East, or these sorts of responses that's sort of following along a previous trajectory.
But you have to look at the time frame of the game different groups play in. From the standpoint of politics, a politician when elected is absolutely first priority has to be getting reelected, which means whatever they do in the next 3 or 4 years has to pay off before that next election so they can claim some kind of a success. Mm-hmm. Well, what they do is they know that something like climate change is not going to be so catastrophic it's undeniable. So they keep their fingers crossed and they go for the short-term things. And remember, children don't vote. So it's not because people are evil or stupid. It's just that children are not a factor determining re-election. And of course, the corporate bottom line is determined by the quarterly report. You can't look, decades ahead. It's a very short focus. And so that perpetuates the game rules that people are playing with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, I think environmental impact cosmetically is different. The world's awash with greenwash. Like 20 years ago, nobody pretended to be green. Now everybody pretends to be green. But it's really about looking good and doing dick. Like, let me give you an example. Emissions per unit of GDP. And that's so that Stephen Harper or, Marcel Coutol from Canadian Oil Sands can show that we've reduced our amount of carbon that we emit per unit of GDP. What they don't tell you is how much GDP has grown and has totally dwarfed that. I guess the good news, so the sense that it's good, is that we have to even make some deference to the environment, because 20 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about emissions per GDP. Nobody would care. The bad news is it's all greenwash, because it doesn't do anything to actually restrain the increase in emissions, which is precisely why we target it, because it's environmentally meaningless, but more importantly, because it doesn't cost the economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that we seem to be going up against a significant Goliath, in the sense we've got an entire system. We've got major corporations and major media, which largely front for those corporations, that have been able to manipulate public messaging to such an extent that in this country, you can't advocate for something like a carbon tax without...
Yes.
But look at the leader the Conservatives and the NDP are fighting and saying, no, we're not agreeing on a carbon tax.
Well, that's because the leader of a major party, the Liberals, ran on the carbon tax. Before he ran, I begged him, I called him and begged him not to make the carbon tax his platform he was running on. I said, look, you can state the problem is severe. He was educated because he was a minister of the environment, and he saw what the issue was. I said, look, say that climate change is serious, that you advocate putting price on carbon, but it's too important or complex to simply do it as a Liberal Party. We will, if you elect me, this is what I told him. You tell him, if you elect me, I will set up an all-party committee charged with coming up with a way to put a price on carbon within 6 months after I'm elected. Mm-hmm. And that way you leave the details out of it. You simply indicate this is coming. But no, to his credit, he said, no, I believe in this. I think it's got to be done and I'm willing to run on it. Mm-hmm. Well, he was devastated. I mean, the original guy in the Liberals to propose it was Ignatieff. Proposed the carbon tax. But once he saw what happened to Dion, when he became leader, he backed away and cozied up to the tar sands, and it became a toxic idea. I was at a conference, the 20th anniversary of the National Roundtable on the Environment and Economy, and I gave a talk there, and during the talk, they people participating voted on what they felt was the most important thing necessary. 80%, and Preston Manning was there, all kinds of commentators, right-wing commentators were there. 80% of them said a carbon tax had to be the most powerful instrument that should be enacted.
Mm-hmm. Here's the good news. The good news is that in 2009, emissions in the U.S. economy, emissions in the Canadian economy, emissions in the global economy all fell without a carbon tax. You know why they fell? GDP shrank. That's the world that I see in the
future.
There's
a direct correlation between carbon dioxide and consumption of energy.
It's direct drive, okay?
Because the economics is all about energy.
Because our economy, between coal and oil, you're talking 70% mm-hmm. of the energy that drives the world economy, okay? So when GDP stops growing, our combustion of coal and oil stops growing. In fact, it declines, and carbon emissions fall as a byproduct, as a corollary. Believe me, Obama, the U.S. Senate, they didn't take any measures in 2009. The Waxman-Markey bill, climate change bill, died on the Senate floor. Emissions still fell because U.S. GDP shrank. That's the good news.
Yeah. Well, it might not be good news because, in the sense that people who are, they're gearing their behavior around the bottom line is what's my pension fund's going to be like. I mean, they'll say, oh, yes, I will ride a bicycle as much as I can, I'll drive buy a hybrid as opposed to a regular automobile. But the fundamental problem is that we've developed this system where we need to grow the economy in order to protect my nest egg.
Yeah, but there's no way that we're going to reduce the human footprint without impacting economic activity. Okay, I mean, if you think so, you're pie in the sky. And when we talk about economic activity, I come back to my earlier point that, you know, 70% of GDP is consumption. Okay, so there's no way that we're going to reduce the human imprint on the environment without affecting consumption growth. And there's just no way of getting around that. We just have to settle it. Now, I think for countries like Canada, that's not quite the apocalyptic sacrifice that some people make it out. In the developing world, admittedly, a whole set of other issues.
Well, if we're really serious about resolving these problems, that would mean wouldn't it mean a dramatic change in the way we live our lives? I mean, global trade depends on transportation, which is fueled by fossil fuels. Yet all of our politicians pay lip service to trade.
You know,
right?
Maybe the whole...
Are we not talking about localization?
Exactly. That was the point of my whole first book, that in a world of triple-digit oil prices, distance costs money, that transport costs aren't incidental, that it doesn't make necessarily sense to employ the cheapest labor force if they're halfway around the world, because what you save on wages, you'll squander on bunker fuel. I think it means exactly re-engineering our economy. But there are silver linings. Who would ever have dreamt that triple-digit oil prices can breathe new life into our hollowed-out rust belt? But believe me, in a world of triple-digit oil prices, it doesn't make any economic sense for North America to import steel from China.
No, it's a radical overhaul, no question. Canada is a northern country, and yet Canadians don't think anything of the fact that they can eat fresh tomatoes and apples and lettuce in the middle of winter. How do they think these are grown? They're not grown in Canada. Mm-hmm. They're shipped from halfway around the world. Was it you, Jeff, that told me that shipping an apple from New Zealand to Canada adds 1 cent per apple? I mean, it's trivial. And yet you start thinking about, my God, that apple should cost 10 or 15 bucks. But it's because the energy is cheap, relatively cheap, and what we do to the atmosphere mm-hmm. isn't included in that economic system. We don't have to pay the price for that.
But you know, when David and I were growing up, you know, when you went into the supermarket store in January, and if you wanted raspberry or blueberry, you go to the canned goods section. Hey, I survived. You know, people weren't dropping dead of malnutrition in Toronto in the 1960s, were they, David?
Not that I know of.
So I'm kind of thinking, though, I mean, you're looking at the general public, and I mean, the good news, as you put, is that collapse will sort of take things out of the hands of of the people who legislate over us. But what if, like, there are possibilities that people could move to a more sustainable lifestyle, but in the meantime, you could see a lot of people scapegoating and, you know, blaming those folks over there for their problems.
I think
their
more and more people are recognizing that life isn't about all about stuff. The unhappiness that comes with a life of stuff. I mean, we just went to a house today that's going to be auctioned in Winnipeg, and it's 5,000 square feet, which to me is a massive amount of space. And you got to fill that space with stuff. And I don't think that there's any correlation with all this stuff and happiness. In fact, there have been a number of studies showing that you get to a certain level of affluence when your basic needs are well met, then more and more stuff with the growth in GDP not add to any more happiness. Poll after poll in the United States shows people would much rather have more time off than more money to buy more stuff. When I was a kid growing up in the 50s, I used to read Popular Mechanics, and there used to be articles about the world in the year 2000, and we'd all be flying in our little helicopters.
The Jetsons.
And and there would be little robots running around the house doing all our work. Well, guess what? It's happened. I have computers in my house. I have a voicemail on my phone, and I have a microwave oven, and I've got all this stuff. But you know what? I have to work harder now. I don't have a lot of time left over. I have to answer these goddamn voicemails that are there. In the past, if someone called you and didn't get you, he'd call again. Now I've got to answer them. Emails come in and people then call me and say, did you get my email? They sent it 1 hour ago and they want an answer. Everything is sped up and we're, you know, and I think most people know that this isn't what makes us happy. We're just running around faster and faster, but...
In fact, last week a survey came out that once again showed Denmark as the highest standard of living. Here's a country that charges 30 cents per kilowatt hour for power, which is about 3 to 4 times what your listeners would be paying in Winnipeg, and where they slap 150% surcharge on a car depending on how big your engine is. You don't see thousands of people in Denmark lining up to emigrate to cheap energy places like Canada and the United States. So, come on. I mean, like, energy consumption per capita is not the bellwether and the be-all of the human condition.
Let me just say, I want to tell people, hey, people, let's sit down and think. My great teacher, my mentor, was my father. In 1994, he was dying of cancer, and he knew it. He wasn't afraid. And I moved in to live with him for the last few months of his life and took care of him. And that was one of the happiest times I spent with my dad. Now, he was not a rich man, but he kept saying, David, I'm going to die a very wealthy man. And in all the time that we spent together, we laughed, we cried. He never once said, do you remember that car I had in 1994? Do you remember that big house we owned in London or that closet full of fancy clothes? All we talked about were family, friends, and neighbors and the things that we did together. To my father, that was his wealth. And in that, he was truly a wealthy man. And that, for me, just focused on what it is that life's about. Life isn't about money and stuff. It's about other people and the love we share and the things that we do together that makes us feel good. We got off on this funny tangent that having more stuff is what makes us happy.
Mm. And that kind of leads to, I think, well, maybe a concluding thought. I know that Martin Luther King, in his famous speech, I Have a Dream, he was articulating a positive vision for the future. With the sense that if you want to achieve a better world, you first have to be able to visualize it. So I'm wondering, if we were to move to the year 2030, what economic vision or ecological vision, what eco-vision should we be moving toward? What would it look like? What would it feel like? What would it sound like?
Well, I think in many ways, for me, Vancouver is moving towards that. The urban farming movement is very, very strong and well-entrenched. The City Council of Vancouver now is committed to working to make Vancouver the greenest city in the world by 2020. So what you find is young people especially are driving this whole use of land in the city, like lawns, converting it to growing food and converting the tops of buildings to be green roofs and grow food. You can now raise at least 3 chickens in your backyard in the middle of Vancouver, as long as they're not roosters. The bike movement in Vancouver, where we're actually taking over lanes from cars and converting them into pedestrian and bike lanes, this represents, I think, huge changes. Greater densification, where we're moving towards smaller homes, more people in the same area, and moving towards areas where you don't need a car because you walk out and everything's going on the streets. That's where your friends are. That's where your fellow workers are. You live, work, and play in the same areas. And then you develop local differences. There might be a Chinese area, or there might be a Latin American area, and they're connected by rapid transit. So you jump in, which I hope is free, mm-hmm. should be free throughout the city. You just jump on and commute over to the next neighborhood with the diversity that you enjoy. But I think that, cities are where most of us now live. We have to make them places that we really enjoy and not convert them into easier and easier movement of cars, mm-hmm. but people.
Jeff Rubin, would you like to
add to that? I think the static economy of the future, because that's what we're heading to, is going to be quite different from what we've known. I think job sharing is going to become the norm because, of course, when economies don't grow like they used to, they can't create the same number of jobs. But, maybe we'll have more leisure time, and that perhaps is not the calamity. I think we're going to have a local economy. Because we're not going to be able to afford to buy everything made halfway around the world. It's just going to cost too much money. We're going to have a more diversified economy in that people aren't going to be buying the same thing anywhere all over the world. Like you walk into a Starbucks, it doesn't matter what country, it's a cafe latte. I think that when you get to local economies, when production and markets become tied to each other, all of a sudden, local tastes that have been buried in the onset of globalization come back to the fore, because you're not producing for some anonymous world market. You're producing for the market where you're right next door. So in many ways, I think the economy of the future is going to curiously look a lot like the economy of the past.
Okay. Well, David Suzuki and Jeff Rubin, ecologist and economist, authors, and you're going on a tour across the country. I want to thank you very much for participating in this conversation. I thought it was very intriguing, and I wish you well for the duration of your tour.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.